Aloha. It is Tuesday, July 9th. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Then there was one interested bidder left to be considered to build a new Aloha Stadium Entertainment District. We talked to the chair of the Stadium Authority. Should we be worried? And mining our offshore seabeds, not so fast. A bill to block the effort in Hawaiian waters was just signed into law. We take a closer look. Plus, culinary arts cachet. Roy Yamaguchi steps out as the new executive director of the Culinary Arts Institute of the Pacific, with a little help from the Culinary Institute of America. The conversation starts right after the latest local and national headlines. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Let's be honest. Our Aloha Stadium has not been without drama, and a lot of it. Shuttered years ago before rail pulled into the station, University of Hawaii Rainbow Warriors left scrambling for a new football field, and high school football players left wondering what just happened. And then a push-me-pull-you back and forth over whether to do a public-private partnership in very dense high-rise towers. Lawmakers and the governor finally gave the nod to put out for bid the creation of an entertainment center, a venue for sports and concerts and housing and maybe even a hotel someday. We invited the chair of the Stadium Authority, Brennan Morioka, to chat with us. Two interested development teams were going forward. Then all of a sudden, one dropped out. Waiola Development Partners said no thanks, leaving Aloha Halawa District Partners as the last one standing. So the public is wondering what happens now and what does this mean going forward? Here's Morioka.
How are we ensuring fairness and how are we ensuring that the state is getting the best deal possible, knowing that we're only down to one proposer? And, you know, part of it is being out there in public, talking about this, making sure that people are aware and informed because, you know, if people don't have the information out there or in front of them, then they start making their own assumptions. And oftentimes the assumptions can just run wild. And so, you know, that's why we appreciate opportunities like this to be out and talking about what is going on and what we're doing. And so we're also very involved in the community. We participate in all the surrounding neighborhood boards, AIA Community Association. We're there very regularly. And then we also do a lot of other radio shows as well as TV appearances just to make sure that the public knows that we're trying to be as transparent as possible. But now that the big announcement that Waiola Development Partners had withdrawn, we had two. You know, the procurement process was we put out a request for proposal or request for qualifications out in December of last year. In February, we received a number of applications and two were deemed to be qualified to move forward. One was WDP and the other is AIA Halawa Development Partners or AHDP. And we were moving forward with both of them and we were having conversations with both, both engaging with the community. And about 2 weeks ago or so, or 3 weeks ago, WDP informed us that they were deciding to withdraw according to the letter. And we can only speculate if there's anything else, but their letter said that they did not believe that they could fulfill the requirements of the project to the level of standards or quality that they're normally used to of holding upon themselves. We are in the process of trying to see from the Attorney General's office when we are going to be able to get approvals or authority to go and have this conversation. Because we are in active procurement, we're not sure exactly if we're able to engage with WDP now that they've withdrawn.
Right, because you don't want to monkey up the...
Exactly. And so as soon as we get some kind of opinion from the AG's office that we can, in fact, maybe have a debrief with WDP to maybe learn a little bit more what was behind the withdrawal, we'll move forward on that. But in the meantime, we have been engaging with AHDP, AIA Halawa Development Partners. And the benefit of actually not having a second proposer is it actually allows us to have more meaningful, in-depth, and detailed conversations with the final proposer, because without WDP, we think that Aiea Halawa Development Partners will be a little bit more open in their conversations with us, sharing a little bit more their financial plans, their development plans, some things that they might have considered proprietary and didn't want someone else taking their ideas. And so that level of conversation has actually been able to allow us to accelerate discussion and process. So we do think that we're going to end up getting a better proposal from them at the end when their proposals are due to us July 31st. And our schedule was that we were going to receive both proposals, evaluate them against each other, make sure that they are both compliant, and then make us rank them 1 and 2 by September and move forward with a single proposer. And now, because we only have one, we can start that more meaningful conversation sooner. So we can actually accelerate the process a little bit.
I can see you'd want to find out what did the other group find too risky?
You know,
the numbers didn't crunch out for them. And maybe what needs to be looked at with, you know, the last man standing.
Yeah. But with regard to whether or not we're going to get value, the RFP is crafted in such a way that we have certain requirements that will still have to be met by AHDP. Even those minimum requirements will provide us with a stadium that we were going to be happy with. They cannot provide us anything less, right? So there are certain standards. You know, we said no less than 25,000 seats, a certain number of luxury suites so that we can generate additional revenues and provide different kinds of customer experiences, food and beverage differences, concerts, you know, the ability to provide better accommodations for concerts to come in rather than having the concerts spend all that money in shipping their audiovisual, their speakers, their sound systems, all of that kind of stuff. And so all of that still has to be included in the stadium. From the very beginning and till to today, the state was only going to be putting in $350 million into the stadium portion of the project. The legislature appropriated about $400 million to us in total, a little bit less, but almost $400 million. Some of that money, about $50 million, needs to be used for consultant work. Some is going to be for construction management costs during construction of the stadium, and then also a very small amount of contingency, just in case.
Have we studied this enough? Has it been studied to death? Because we've had so much money go out the door.
And it has, yes, it has been. A lot of the money has been spent on like the environmental impact statements. We did a programmatic master plan for the site so that we know exactly what can and cannot be done. The community has been a very integral part of the development of the programmatic master plan, as well as the city's transit-oriented development Halawa plan. And so a lot of the wants and not wants, I guess you could say, of the community, you know, what the community wants to see in this development and what they don't want to see in this development is all incorporated into these master plans. So number one, I think whatever is going to be proposed or what is going to be approved to be developed is going to be something that the community is going to be happy with because they had a lot of say in what the parameters are. And like I was saying, the state only committed to $350 million to the stadium. And we know based on what our requirements are, it's going to cost way more than that. Our estimate right now is about $425 to $450 million to build the stadium that we are demanding as a part of this contract. And so the developer is going to be putting in a lot more money than what we're going to be providing. So they have a lot of skin in the game, which is also why we had to include the surrounding development into the project because they needed a source of revenue to generate, to pay for the investment that they're making up front. Also, a lot of the infrastructure that they're going to be putting in up front and for the district. And so they have a lot of vested interest in making sure that the development occurs and it occurs quickly. It's not just going to be land that's going to be sitting aside, not doing anything. So we're very optimistic that this project is going to be moving forward and moving forward fairly rapidly once we get under contract, and which is scheduled for June of 2025.
Brendan Morioka, the University of Hawaii College of Engineering Dean and Chair of the Aloha Stadium Authority. We will hear more about the plans for the Aloha Stadium Entertainment District, but let's first take a quick break.
The World takes you outside U.S. borders and connects you with the most important events happening all across this big blue marble. We introduce you to memorable people whose stories will stick with you. I'm Carolyn Beeler, global news and inspiring voices that connect us with people around the globe. Join us weekdays on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
On the next Fresh Air, when a 47-year-old man has a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl who is his art student, can you call the relationship consensual, even if she thinks she's madly in love with him? What if they marry and stay married until his death at the age of 93? We'll talk with Jill Cement about her new memoir, Consent. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Let's get back to our interview with the chair of the Aloha Stadium Authority. Brendan Morioka is currently the engineering dean at the University of Hawaii. Previously, he was with Hawaiian Electric Company's Transportation Electrification Division. Prior to that, he was with HART, so he knows something about construction and utility issues. He's also served as state transportation director, so he knows about drama, too. Remember the Super Ferry? Morioka is keenly aware of community pushback and the infrastructure needs of large projects.
Infrastructure is one of the critical items for this project. And it's not just sewer, it's water, electricity. So our team and the developers have been having close conversations with all of the different utilities, Hawaiian Electric, Board of Water Supply, as well as the city on ENV for the trunk sewer that's going to come up Kamehameha Highway. And so right now, the city's plan is to bring this trunk sewer up to the Halawa area in approximately 2032, 2033. So that is a few years away, but the current stadium and the Kamehameha lot, which is where the transit station is, those areas have sufficient sewer capacity for development. So we can build the stadium, we can build that initial first phase of development. And if you think about how long it typically takes construction, having the sewer line come in around 2032, 2033 actually works out fairly well with some of the other phases or the next phases in construction of the development. And so I'm pretty optimistic that the timing works out. But even if the timing doesn't work out completely, there are technologies today that, especially in San Francisco, where San Francisco requires all new high-rises to process its own wastewater on site and treat the water so that it's reusable, either for irrigation or even potable for drinking water purposes. So we've visited some of those companies and we understand what their technology is. It is affordable. And so if there are certain buildings, and some developers here in Hawaii are already using some of these on-site technologies in their high-rises. So it's not like Hawaii builders are not aware of this technology. And so we do think, should there be a need to provide on-site wastewater treatment, that technology is available and we can do it. And then just as a transition point, okay, Board of Water Supply would also like us to do that kind of technology, because if we can provide treated reusable water, whether it's for drinking or for irrigation, that also takes a burden off of their resource, right? So we don't have to tap into their aquifers, into their water supply, by providing some of our own. So, you know, in working with the states, what it's called the One Water Committee, and it's both wastewater, drainage, and drinking water. And
yeah, you got to engineer all of that.
It's a much more comprehensive look at how we use water resources. And so we've been a part of that conversation with them. So they know exactly what we're planning. We understand what their limitations are as well. And so I'm pretty optimistic that the utility side is going to work itself out over time.
Okay. And then even with the power, I mean, I know given your experience with, you were at Hawaiian Electric for a right. while, and then with rail, sadly, right, the rail station opened and Aloha Stadium closed. And so that just hurts on the ridership side, because that was going to be a draw.
Yes, less attractions for the rail system. But I think once it does open up, and especially when the rail line gets to and past the airport, you know, and some of the developments, especially the initial developments on the Kamehameha lot, is probably going to include a hotel. You know, that's our guess. And just that kind of opportunity for both tourists as well as neighbor island residents, maybe, or even those people coming to work at Pearl Harbor at the shipyard or something, or on base, they're going to have another alternative for someplace to stay. Because if you look at the hotels that are being built and opened on the west side in Kapolei and Ewa, their occupancies are just through the roof. And so having more options, inventory for people to have stays outside of Waikiki is going to be tremendous. And to be connected by the rail to the airport. And then as HART continues to open into downtown in Kaka'ako, by the early 2030s, when the stadium development is really going to get full bore, I think just those kinds of opportunities for not just residential opportunities, but recreational work, all of that kind of things. And then the events, right? The football games, concerts, whatever it is, tying into all the way into Kaka'ako. Rail is going to be a tremendous asset to the stadium parcel. The stadium and the entertainment district is going to work very nicely in complementing the rail system. So everything is meant to be very intentional and purposeful in connecting with each other, right? Transportation is meant to provide support for opportunities, events, recreation. And all of that is also meant to provide ridership to the rail system.
And the interchange, right? Because that, if I recall, that got put off, you know, and, right. And the Central Oahu folks, right? I mean, that whole feeder line.
Yep. We believe that this project is a very essential project to many, many different aspects of things we do, especially in infrastructure here in Hawaii, where the NACED is going to be a big part of the transformation of rail, transportation in general, but then also it is meant to be a gathering place on a more regular basis rather than just every other Saturday during the fall. Because UH only plays maybe 7 games out of the entire year. People don't really realize that high school football actually plays 3 times more football games at the stadium than UH did. And so we've engaged with the Department of Education and the Hawaii High School Sports Association. And so, you know, we're working with all the different stakeholders, as well as many of the concert promoters, on what we need to be doing. And then we also have interest by other professional sports leagues like
soccer,
World Rugby, USL Soccer. The opportunities are there for us to really grow and make this place something that can be used on an everyday basis rather than just on every weekend.
A real magnet.
Yes.
Anything else? Any closing thoughts? Oh, I think you got to change the name, NACED. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, that's just a placeholder. We get asked that all the time. Is NACED the permanent name? We don't know, but, you know, hopefully we'll be able to provide additional updates as we get the final proposals from AHDP. And this conversation is not the end of it, right? They will continue to have to, and number one, they're not guaranteed the contract. They still have to meet all the qualifications, submit a compliant proposal. Because if it's not of value to the state, we are willing to walk away because we're not going to be wasting all this taxpayer money to get something that we're not going to be happy with. And so it has to be a compliant proposal, build the stadium that we're asking for, do the development that surrounds it, that the community is demanding. And then this developer will have to continually engage with the community, with elected officials, with stadium authority to ensure that what they're doing is in accordance with the contract and that it continues to be something that we're going to be able to enjoy and take advantage of for generations to come.
That was Brennan Morioka, chair of the Aloha Stadium Authority, talking to us about NAZED, which stands for the New Aloha Stadium Entertainment District. This is a conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today we look back on the life of famed Hawaiian musician Aaron Mahi. You may know him for his work as a trio with fellow musicians Martin Pahinui and George Kuo on the album Ho'olohe, released in 2003. During his long and storied career, he filled many roles: kahu, composer, conductor, and recording artist. Fun fact, HBR's very own Derek Malama had Mahi as an arts and crafts teacher during a summer fun event at Fern Park in Kalihi back in the 90s. However, Mahi's biggest accomplishment by far was serving as the bandmaster of the Royal Hawaiian Band in 1981. He was appointed by then Honolulu Mayor Eileen Anderson, and he led the band for 24 years up until 2005. In 1983, while on tour in Germany, Mahi was presented with a Schellenbaum. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us what a Schellenbaum is? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NareitHawaii.com.
The governor this week signed a number of bills into law that aims to protect our environment. One of them has to do with seabed mining in our territorial waters. Here to tell us more about it is HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what can you tell us about this bill?
Yes, absolutely. So Hawaii has signed a seabed mining ban in its territorial waters, and this ban is also in place in California, Oregon, and Washington. So it's a move kind of across the Pacific with states that rely on these Pacific ecosystems to say seabed mining is not going to work for us. We also have a law in place that was passed last year that allows Hawaii port officials to prevent deep sea mining vessels from docking at our ports. And I talked to Senator Chris Lee, who authored both of those bills, and he says that Hawaii has put up a pretty united front when it comes to seabed mining. Our Representative Ed Case has been pushing for legislation on the national level to get a moratorium on seabed mining. But Hawaii's sphere of influences is limited because it's an international authority, the International Seabed Authority, that actually regulates deep sea mining across the world. And the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, which is just a few hundred miles away from our island, is the zone that people are really, really looking at to mine resources like copper and cobalt and nickel from the seafloor. And the ISA, the International Seabed Authority, is actually going to meet next week to talk about further regulations that they're hoping to pass in 2025 that could pave the way for seabed mining across the world. I talked to Solomon Ko'ohalahala, who is a former Hawaii politician and a conservationist, and he's been going to these ISA meetings as an observer and trying to get more recognition for the importance of the Pacific and its health to indigenous peoples and how deep sea mining may jeopardize that.
The first creature to emerge and create it on this Honua, on this planet, would be the ukukoakoa, and for us, that would be the coral polyp. And then it says in the genealogy of the Kumulipo that all other creatures will follow that. And then the people, we have responsibility for the care of these that have preceded us. They are our elders, and the coral polyp being the eldest of our kupuna. So when you look at the cultural responsibility that we are given inheritance to, it is to remind us that we belong to the ecosystems of the creation of Earth itself. And here is a process, deep sea mining, that is intruding into that place of our creation. And at no time has the authorities who are seeking to allow for this process of deep sea mining have ever considered our cultural input, our cultural genealogy, our cultural perspective. And that to me is dangerous because it now seeks to destroy what I would believe to be the creation of life itself.
You know, as I listen to him speak, I'm reminded of a line that I heard at the FESPAC, you know, where one of the cultural leaders said, we are not just people from tiny islands, but we are caretakers of the largest ocean in the world. Yeah. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, and it's definitely kind of a larger conversation that a lot of leaders around the Pacific are having. And what Solomon identified for me is that the way the ISA currently defines cultural heritage in its laws is extremely limited.
And in that description, they say that culture is tangible artifacts found in the deep sea. It is perhaps human remains that are found in the deep sea. And then lastly, it's perhaps sunken architecture in the deep sea. And they believe that this is everything that has to do with culture. When I asked the question about how do they now relate to my connection to the deep sea, which is the place of my creation, in that this is where my life begins, and that it's not something that is tangible and that you can't hold it in your hands. The council was a little perplexed about my input.
Yeah, another dimension to consider.
Absolutely. And so Solomon has actually pushed the ISA to reconsider this language. And so a review of the new definition is on the agenda for the upcoming meeting, which is next week. So that's something that we're going to be following. And he says that just across the board, it's especially important for Native Hawaiians and other Indigenous people, but specifically people from Hawaii, to have a presence at the conference, because the U.S. cannot fully advocate for their interests, since the U.S. is not a voting member of the International Seabed Authority.
The United States did not ratify the Treaty of the High Seas. And because it did not ratify that treaty, the United States cannot sit in the body that is authorized to be the ones to create policies for the high seas. So that is a problem for me, in that we are under the occupation of the United States, and we happen to be the island nation that is in the middle of the largest ocean on this planet Earth, and the planning for mining is adjacent to our islands, and there is no one there that is speaking on our behalf, not even the United States. And so it is clear that we needed to be there to be our own advocacy, and we have brought with us the strength of our Indigenous perspective, which brings us back to our cultural connection to this space by the Kumulipu.
And I think it's probably important to underscore that it is not that the U.S. doesn't want to be at the table. I mean, I just saw a piece on this by 60 Minutes that said that the political divisions in Congress are what's kind of preventing us from being at the table to even discuss some of the stuff. And meanwhile, places like China are just, you know, making headway in this area with undersea mining.
Yes, so there are about 24 countries that have come forward saying that they would support a moratorium on seabed mining, but there are other countries, including China, that are really, really pushing for it. And in that Clarion-Clipperton zone, a large percentage of that zone would be under China's jurisdiction if they were able to get a permit for mining. There's also private companies like the Metals Co. out of Canada, who is really saying that the minerals that are in the seabed are necessary for certain things in the clean energy transition. So other folks are looking to say, okay, if we do not want to use the seabed minerals in order to make sure that we have batteries for our clean energy transition, where else can we get those resources? And laws in California, for instance, and in other states that are turning away from seabed mining have looked at rights repair laws, so we're making sure that we're not throwing away cobalt and nickel and copper that still can have valuable use. And also just making sure that there's recognition that this is really going to affect the ecosystems first and foremost of the Pacific. So those states and those communities need to be a part of the conversation.
Yeah, so hopefully they can break the logjam there between the Republicans and Democrats, and we can move forward so we can be at the table to have these discussions.
Certainly, and we'll be keeping an eye on that ISA conference that starts next week for some of these developments.
Okay. All right. Well, we appreciate you doing that. Thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We have been talking with HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. You can look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho grant at oha.org/kanaho grant.
For nearly 7 years, anthropologist Jason De Leon was embedded with smugglers who move migrants across the southern border. It's changed his view of that world from an act of exploitation to a necessary evil.
They're really a symptom of this much bigger problem of migration, of capitalism. And, you know, at the end of the day, they're providing a service for people who really need it.
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com.
Culinary Institute of America has produced top chefs across the country, including Hawaii's Roy Yamaguchi. The restaurateur has taken over as executive director at the Culinary Institute of the Pacific here on Oahu. And now students will have the opportunity to tap resources at both places to get them on their way to a career in the kitchen. The Culinary Collaboration will provide an intensive study and a new certificate program to help develop our workforce. The Hawaii Tourism Authority will help launch the program with scholarships this fall. We invited Yamaguchi and Kapi'olani Community College Professor Grant Itamura to talk about this new partnership and to give us a sense of the things to come at the Diamond Head facility. Yamaguchi credits his wife, Denise, who has worked behind the scenes developing relationships to make this happen. The goal is culinary excellence, from creating in the kitchen to developing value-added products for the market to expanding hospitality opportunities. Yamaguchi starts us off.
It's pretty exciting. You have to understand that also that there's been a lot of great, or still is a lot of great, you know, chef instructors like Alan Tsuchiyama, and you know, there's new ones like Chris Garnier, who's moved from Leeward Community College to there. And I think that all the great efforts that, you know, have been put in on the culinary side, you know, as far as teaching and, you know, all of that good stuff, I think it's going to be continue to be great.
And then we just formed a new alliance, a new partnership, right? So tell us about that.
Yeah, so, you know, I graduated from the Culinary Institute of America, you know, way back, many years ago. I keep on thinking it's only yesterday, but
I know, it seems like it,
but
right?
But it's not.
We have gray hair now.
Yeah, but it's not. So, you know, so that's where I was able to build my foundation, you know, the learning experience, all of that. So, and then for about 12 years, I was the a trustee at the school, and currently a trustee emeritus. So I know what the school went through and seen a lot of great things that have happened at the CIA. So, you know, I thought that it would be a great opportunity because the CIP is now kind of coming into fruition and it's going to be opening, that there's different things that we can do on campus there. Because at the end of the day, what we want that campus to be is a world-class center for culinary excellence. So there's a lot of moving parts. And I thought that one of the ways that we can really get it off the ground and get some ideas from an institution that has done extremely well, CIE is considered, you know, the world's premier culinary college. So I reached out to them to collaborate on these efforts. But, you know, it was originally started by Denise. So, you know, Denise Yamaguchi was the one who actually brought individuals out to see the CIA facilities to get them in tune to what CIP can become. And with that, you know, I was able to just make a call and just say, hey, listen, you know what, here it is. Everybody's been to see you guys. And, you know, now's a chance to come join us and help us out and, you know, have this collaboration. So with that CIA help, I think that, you know, CIP institution is going to go extremely further.
Yeah, and Grant, jump in here, because, you know, I drive by the Culinary Institute, you know, almost every other day as I head down to the beach to go swimming, and you see the construction that's going on. And I remember the days of the Cannon Club, and so I'm looking forward to this next phase.
Yeah, it's interesting. We get calls all the time looking for reservations, because what they see right now is part of phase one, which was built in 2017. So we have two functioning classroom kitchens there. But hopefully within the upcoming year, we'll see a lot more additions to it, which includes Food for Thought Creative Center, where we focus on what do we need to deliver to the state that will help prosper, help us grow. That's in line with culinary arts, but also expanding a bit more to areas maybe we didn't really think about. So whether it's specializing in, you know, what we do best agriculturally here in Hawaii, whether it's coffee or chocolates, things like that. So development, those kind of courses, along with learning how to develop entry-level processes on product development. Again, we're also tied with Leeward, so Leeward can have an opportunity to see some of our students go there where they can add more to the value-added product. We have an auditorium that's also coming up, which is kind of a unique setup where we can broadcast all over the world. So again, being wow, world-class, globally competitive is very important to us. So we can have courses, whether it's on wine pairing or sensory evaluation. I mean, it's pretty endless. And I always feel like it's an opportunity for the community to come join us and share with us and share ideas on what this space could become, because we have our ideas, but I'm sure there's many more things we could probably fit into this space. And the more we can do that, we can involve the community. And of course, the thing that everyone's waiting for is the restaurant. So the restaurant is currently near completion, but we're about a year out, and we're going to have a lot of inquiries on that. We get them every day looking for reservations, but just to let people know that hopefully by next year sometime we'll be able to open the doors there.
Explain to me and to our listeners, you know, this whole thing of having culinary programs at West Oahu or on the neighbor islands. What's the philosophy behind that?
Yeah, you know, so we're all part of the Culinary Institute of the Pacific. So I think when you go to each of these programs, you'll find the uniqueness in each of our programs. So each island has a specialty in what they focus on. Even here on Oahu, we have two programs with Leeward and ourselves. And again, our focus is starting to evolve a little bit more on how we're not duplicating the resources, but how we're helping to build upon each other. So I feel like that's a really strong thing that we do. Not only do we do it with the other community colleges, but we also tie into four-year programs with University of Hawaii as well as UH West Oahu.
So you get the basics at the community colleges, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so that's our premise, to try to set up the basic foundation. And if they're interested in culinology, then it's more of the applied science, and that goes to the University of Hawaii. And if they're interested in opening their own business, we have a applied science that we look at with UH West Oahu.
Well, you know, I went down to Big Island Candies to pick up some omiyage for an upcoming trip. And it was just nice to, you know, see, okay, the seasonal guava shortbread, and, you know, you have the mac nuts and the Kona coffee. But it must make you feel really good to know how our products are out there.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, listen, at the end of the day, you know, there's people that come to Hawaii and to get omiyage because, you know, there's a lot of great products that we have here. And I think that for the last 5 to 10 years, you know, more than ever, I think there's a lot more passionate, food-loving, agricultural individuals in those principles that are getting more involved and doing a lot of great things in the food business for Hawaii. So, you know, it's just nice to see these people come into the picture to, you know, create and continue to work to make our hospitality or whether it be our food manufacturing or whatever it is, to see it even better and better and to grow it into something more awesome than ever before. You're going to continue to see that. And I really feel that there's a lot more younger entrepreneurs that are coming into the picture, maybe because of what we went through with COVID. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are very, very passionate that are out there coming on board. So I think that, you know, our industry, you know, whether it be from the food manufacturing or just restaurant or farming, whatever it may be, you know, I think it's going to continue to get better and grow.
Well, you know, on our show, we featured a number of people over the years. And recently we had the sake maker that moved from Oahu to Kaka'ako to Mauna Kea on the Big Island. And he was saying, oh, they have a byproduct when they make sake that he says you can use to make ice cream. He was like, sake ice cream. You know, and I was like, oh, and at the time I was into making ice cream. So I bought some. I went down to Chinatown and ordered some. And so, you know, it's just that value added, you know, things that would have been discarded in the process of making mac nut oil, right? So there's another entrepreneur that's turned that into another awesome product.
Yeah, I mean, when you really think about it, just from what I understand, you know, somebody was making sake in Hawaii many years ago, and then it stopped. And now, you know, there's companies out there making a lot of rum, you know, and vodka and, you know, whiskey and you know, getting into shochu and, mm-hmm. and sake once again. But I think that these are all entrepreneurs that, you know, of course, I'm guessing that they're in it to create a profit. But, you know, they have a lot of love for the land. You know, they're very, very passionate about what they do. And trying to make, you know, artesian, you know, I mean, really kind of like the heirloom type products. So, you know, which is a great thing because it just continues to make Hawaii better. But, you know, it's the past that they're, you know, reaching out to.
Pay homage. Yeah,
and pay homage and to move forward with all of that. So, you know, I think it's great.
That was Roy Yamaguchi and Grant Utomitsu from the Culinary Institute of the Pacific. We'll continue our conversation with them right after a break.
Marketplace is here to help you make sense of this new economic reality. We know that you rely on trusted journalism to navigate this uncertainty, and that's a privilege and a responsibility that public media takes seriously. And we are committed to connecting the dots for you through these times. So please join me, Kai Rizdal, every weekday on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Mark Nepo, author of You Don't Have to Do It Alone, and next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about friendship as an island of safety.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Let's get back to our chat with Chef Roy Yamaguchi and Professor Grant Utomitsu from the Culinary Institute of the Pacific. We wanted to know about enrollment numbers, still not back up to pre-pandemic days. You know, we took a hit during the COVID shutdown, and it was a scary time as places and restaurants were slow to reopen. Here's Utomitsu.
In terms of enrollment, I would say we've been pretty lucky. Yes, we took a big hit during the pandemic, but I think a lot of the programs across the state were able to pivot, so we would come back face-to-face sooner than most academic programs. So that really helped save us and really helped keep our numbers up. So we're slowly growing. Last semester, we were just under 250 students in our program. So we're hoping to achieve that number or slightly higher as we move forward. And with all the publicity, with all the marketing that's going on with all of our programs, we're hopefully going to see that. And obviously, there's a high demand in the industry. So being able to figure out ways to get them into the pipeline of jobs, you know, our program, we have certificates, We have degrees. And now with the CIA-CIP collaboration, we're going to have something that's a week long that will help intensify training, because not everyone can spend 2 years with us, let alone, you know, even shorter, slightly shorter duration. A week might be a lot more possible. So we're trying to attack every avenue we can to help support the state in their shortage of a lot of the culinarians out there.
Well, my neighbor just turned me on to the program they have over at Waipahu High School, you know, where they've got the kids out there in the high school getting excited about creating product and being in the kitchen. And I don't know, what are you seeing, Roy, you know, as far as just the support staff that you need to run a restaurant? You know, what's it been like out there?
Well, I mean, you know, some restaurants are, they probably have, they're better off than others. But in general, at the end of the day, there's a need for our workforce to become, I guess, quality oriented. There's less people going into the business, as far as I can see, and talking to all of my colleagues out there. But, you know, we want to make it so that, you know, we have culinary programs that we can entice students to, you know, pursue, you know, the culinary dream. So that's one thing. We need to develop a stronger workforce development program so that we can have better qualified, or we can enhance, you know, their skills. That's why we wanted to bring CIA and start this workforce program so that we can better our culinarians. And not only from the hospitality industry, because there's other industries that need to become better, whether it be the healthcare industry or whether it be the military. And, you know, quite frankly, we have gotten a lot of response from the military and from the healthcare because, you know, they want to see their industry grow.
Well, yeah,
you
got
get better.
So. You got the mess hall cook that are creating things back in the kitchen for the troops.
And then, you know, when I was growing up, you know, I actually took home ec in high school. And that's how I got involved in the culinary scene. And even back then, you know, I used to go eat in mess halls and, you know all these little places. And, you know, and hey, listen, you know, we used to eat this thing called SOS.
Yes. I grew up eating that.
You know.
Chip beef on toast.
Chip beef on toast, you know. And believe it or not, I mean, whenever I get a chance to eat that stuff, I still eat it because it's pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah, no, I cut my teeth on cheeseburgers at the USO too. So, but, you know, I think when you think about the possibilities, right, for our young people and the fact that we've just gotten on the national stage, right, so many winners, James Beard winners, you know, Robin Mai, I think she got her start in the culinary school on the community college level, and Jason Peel, you know, the folks that are just creating some awesome food out there.
Yeah, I mean, for us, we're really proud because they're not only graduates, but they also were instructors. And you can even add Chef Alan Wong to that list as well. So for us, I mean, it's amazing. And the goal is to keep that level of standard or try to elevate it a bit more with different opportunities. And with the CIA, that's an opportunity. We want to build a reliable workforce, but we also want to build individuals that have opportunities in the culinary industry that may not be something that they thought about 10 years ago. But if we can plant seeds in their mind of what they can do within the industry, it's not limited. It's really much more expansive than what we've seen in the past.
And so with this new relationship, I don't know, what do you see happening then for the fall?
What we were very fortunate that Governor Green had signed his agreement and it was put together by DBED. So we have a three-year agreement to bring the CIA to have this workforce programs throughout the year. So the first two courts will start September 16th. So that's the first one. And that is the INA-based Mediterranean cooking. And then the following week, just what, the 23rd, for 5 days, you know, we have a Pacific Rim plant-forward-based cooking. So, you know, as we continue to build programs other than that, we want to gear towards, of course, trying to make our culinarians stronger and more skillful. That's the start. So that's where we want to start, is to reach out to the community. And, you know, Grant can tell you about non-credit and credit. And this falls into the non-credit side. But, you know, I think my goal would be to get CIA more engaged in the future to help us with, you know, the credit side and help with the curriculum. And I mentioned before, you know, we have a lot of great chef instructors. that have made KCC to what it is and some other culinary programs throughout the state. And we just want to tie everything together and just to make it go even further.
Is there any talk about, I don't know, expanding things? You know, because you often hear like, oh, you go to Italy and you go take a class, a cooking class at, you know, X, Y, and Z or whatever. I mean, any discussion about that?
Well, actually, I'll tell you about a few things that we have already done. And I always start off by saying we are blessed. We're blessed getting support from the state, from our donors, from our administration. So last year, we were able to take a group of 10 students, including two from Leeward Community College, to Barcelona, Spain. So we work with the University of Barcelona there. They have an incredible program. And, you know, it was such a monumental change for us to be able to actually dive in across the world and get real life experiences for our students, even for our faculty that attended. So these are things that without the help or the support of everyone, we wouldn't be able to do. We're lucky we have partnerships with sister programs with Japan. So we work with Fukuoka. We work with Nakamura Gakuin in Fukuoka as well. So there are a lot of opportunities for us. And so part of what we're trying to do is kind of curate them and figure out which ones really tie into the core of who we are here in Hawaii, because we really need to come back down and focus on what we do best here in Hawaii. And that's focusing on foods related to Hawaii. And how does that culture tie in with places around the world, which the world is much smaller now and opportunities are even greater. So we're even looking at possibilities working with Ireland as well.
The sky's the limit. It's a hopeful time for the Culinary Institute of the Pacific. We will have links to that certificate program and how to apply for the inaugural scholarships on the conversation page of our website later today. Earlier, we asked you to tell us what a Schoenbaum is. The late Aaron Mahi was presented with the item while the Royal Hawaiian Band toured Germany back in 1983. The Schoenbaum, also known as the Jingling Johnny, is a percussion instrument that can be recognized by its pole and the many bells and jingles attached to it. To play it, you shake it up and down with both hands in a twisting motion. Prior to Mahi being gifted with the instrument, the Royal Hawaiian Band had one in its inventory, but it was looted sometime after the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom in 1893. Mahi led the Royal Hawaiian Band for 24 years and was only the second bandmaster who was fluent in Hawaiian and German. Mahi passed away last Saturday. He was 70 years old. And that was our quiz today. We had no winners. But if you have an idea for a quiz to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to talk to the Center for Mauna Kea Stewardship about completing the removal of the first telescopes from the mountain. Share your comments or questions about what you heard today. Call our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation segments on Google, Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.